طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where you hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective through Palestinian voices. Today we feature the linking of voices from two different cultures, each representing a people who have faced ethnic cleansing, colonial occupation, and military exploitation, the Palestinians and the Native Americans. There are similarities to their struggles, which is why intersectionality is becoming a dominant theme of activist organizers working for human rights throughout the world. First, you will hear Farouz Sharkawi, representing Grassroots Jerusalem, and then Madonna Thunderhawk from the Lakota Nation. These two women have been traveling the Northeast as part of the Tree of Life tour, and these presentations were recorded when they spoke at the Lincoln Library. The joint presentations run close to an hour, so let's get right to it. First, the Palestinian voice of Farouz Sharkawi.
So again, my name is Farouz Sharkawi. I am the community mobilization and networking coordinator, and also I do advocacy at the organization called Grassroots Jerusalem. Grassroots Jerusalem's mission is to map and gather Palestinian voices that form a Palestinian long-term strategy for Jerusalem. Because in the reality that Palestinian communities live in Jerusalem today, we know and we see that the most crucial thing that we Palestinians in Jerusalem need is our own long-term plan for the city. The question of what's your vision for Jerusalem is the hardest question you can ask a Palestinian. And the reason for that is that Palestinians face a real threat of displacement from their own city. So Palestinians trying to protect their roots in Jerusalem usually find no time and space in mind to think, how do I want my city to look like 10 years down the line? So I will begin with the Jerusalem story to tell you the reality that we live in our beloved city, and then I'll introduce our work in Jerusalem afterwards. So, and again, quoting some of the things that Mary said in her introduction, the story in Palestine in general, but especially in Jerusalem, is of a continuous Nakba. Nakba is the word for catastrophe in Arabic. This is what we call what happened to our people during the war of 1948, when the Zionist movement established the State of Israel. Nakba, catastrophe, is the description of the uprooting of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, the destruction of 600 Palestinian villages that were entirely destroyed during the War of 48. Both my grandparents from my father's side are refugees from the Nakba. Today, I have no idea where their villages were. I mean, I know relatively where, but if I go looking for them, I can't find any remains to show me where my grandparents grew up. And the Palestinian people still live the Nakba. I mean, some people might think that the Nakba ended with the end of the war, but the truth is displacement policies are implemented against Palestinians all the time, especially in Jerusalem, where Israel has a very clear plan of displacing the Palestinian population, reaching a majority of Jewish Israeli residents. Actually, in the main master plan for Jerusalem that was put in the early 70s, the Israeli authorities speak of a demographic balance that they wish to reach in Jerusalem. I bet you're thinking balance, 50-50, but when it comes to Israel and the demographic balance in Jerusalem, Israel wishes to reach a 70% Jewish population, 30% non-Jewish. And that's their terminology, which of course in other main words means 70% Israeli, 30% Palestinian. And this is just the vision for the year 2020. That's the master plan called Jerusalem 2020. It talks about the vision for the city for the year 2020. And that is the demographic imbalance, if I may correct the term, that Israel wishes to achieve in Jerusalem. And the story I'm here to tell you today is how does Israel do that and what are the Palestinians doing regarding these plans. So let's begin with the bad news, the Israeli policies in Jerusalem. During the Nakba, I suppose that most of you know the story of the Nakba. During the Nakba, the Zionist militias ethnically cleansed the western side of the city. The neighborhoods like Talbiye and El Qatamon and El Baqa, villages like El Malha and El Walaje were ethnically cleansed. And the west side of Jerusalem was declared as part of the newly born state of Israel. 20,000 Palestinians became refugees as a result only from Jerusalem. I mean, in general, in the Nakba, the number reached 700,000. 700,000 Palestinians became refugees as a result of the Nakba, refugees that have the right to return to their lands and their homes. There are UN resolutions talking about this right, and of course, there is a whole list of UN resolutions that Israel does not respect. These refugees still wait to return to their lands. And again, as I told you, my father's uncles and my mother's uncles are among those refugees. I have family members in Syria that I have never met. Now, going back, zooming back into Jerusalem, the result of the Nakba was the ethnic cleansing of the west side of the city. And the next war broke out in the year 1967, the Six-Day War. And the result of the Six-Day War was the occupation of the east side of Jerusalem. That is internationally recognized as occupied territory. And since the occupation of the east side of Jerusalem, Israeli authorities started making up and implementing those plans to displace the Palestinian population. And they speak of these policies very openly. I mean, as I said before, the most important master plan for Jerusalem says we're going to limit the number of the Palestinians to 30%. Today, by the way, the population of Jerusalem is around 900,000, both Israeli and Palestinian on both sides of the Green Line, and the Palestinians make almost 40% of that population. That's exactly why in more recent documents, that the Israeli authorities speak of 60 to 40 instead of 70-30. That's a bit more realistic, knowing that 2020 is just in 2 years from now. And the way Israel tries to achieve this relation is by, first of all, encouraging Israelis to move into Jerusalem. Israelis are encouraged to move to live on both sides of the Green Line. The internationally recognized border between Israel and Palestine is called the Green Line. And so more and more housing opportunities are built for Israeli citizens to move into the west side of Jerusalem, but also into the Israeli settlements in the east side of Jerusalem. Today, the number of Israeli settlers in the east side of Jerusalem is estimated at 200,000 settlers out of 650,000 settlers that live in the whole West Bank area. Now, encouraging Israelis to come to fight the demographic war is not enough. Israel also displaces Palestinians from the city on a daily basis, beginning with the legal status that Palestinians hold in Jerusalem. Palestinians in Jerusalem hold the legal status called a permanent residency. Permanent, the part of being permanent is a bit of a lie, because this legal status expires automatically every 10 years. So a Palestinian resident in Jerusalem lives in their own city with a permit from the Israeli authorities. Every 10 years, you need to go renew that permit. And when you go renew it, you have to prove that Jerusalem is the center of your life. That's actually the name of the policy that was coined, the phrase was coined by the Ministry of Interior in the 1980s, center of life. According to this policy, Palestinian residents of Jerusalem have to prove that they actually physically live in Jerusalem, otherwise they have no right to live in it. So as a Palestinian going to renew your ID card, you need to show that you either own or rent a house in Jerusalem, that you have a physical address in the city. You have to prove that you pay your taxes in Jerusalem, most importantly the Arnona housing tax. Arnona is the Hebrew name for it, the housing tax, which is a very high housing tax in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is an awfully expensive city. Real estate prices are really high, and so also the taxation for real estate. And in addition, you also have to prove that you actually practically live in your Jerusalem home. So you have to produce and show water bills and electricity bills. But it doesn't only end there. They don't wait for your ID card to expire every 10 years. They also come in into our neighborhoods, to our homes, knocking at Palestinian doors in the middle of the night to check whether you are actually living in your Jerusalem home. So first of all, they knock on your door to see, are you going to open the door or are you lying to us and you don't actually sleep in your Jerusalem house? And if you are lucky enough to be at home and open the door, that you're not traveling or visiting family or just out late, then that's not enough either. And they will go to your kitchen and check. Do you have fresh bread and milk in your Jerusalem house? Because if you're having coffee and toast somewhere else in the morning, then Jerusalem is not the center of your life. And they will go to your closet in the bedroom and check, do you actually have clothes in Jerusalem? Do you shower in Jerusalem? Because if you shower somewhere else, then Jerusalem is not the center of your life. And if you fail to prove all of these criteria, then you have failed to prove that Jerusalem is the center of your life, and you are expelled out of the city, your residency status is revocated, and you do not have the right to return to Jerusalem. It's needless to say that none of this happens to the Israeli residents in the city. Now, aside from the legal status, Israel tries to uproot literally the Palestinians from Jerusalem by confiscating our lands and demolishing our homes, because these are the main two things to hold you in the land. So on the one hand, the Israeli authorities, which of course control both sides of the city, do not allocate enough lands for Palestinian public use. The Palestinians make 40% of the population, but they receive only 13% of the lands for public use. In addition, Palestinian privately owned land is confiscated all the time. Usually, they use the excuse of needing the land for establishing what they call national parks and municipal parks. According to the Israeli law, the government has the right to confiscate privately owned land if the land is taken for a project that is good for the welfare and the well-being of the community. Now, on paper, national parks look good. But then if you look at the map and see that national parks in Jerusalem are confiscated from Palestinian communities only, and actually very strategically, the land that is confiscated is the last bits of land left for these communities to naturally grow into. So this way, Palestinian communities already heavily populated with no space for more housing for the young couples that get married have no opportunity to grow in their location, and those young couples will have to go look for housing outside of Jerusalem. Of course, once they go live outside of Jerusalem, they will lose the legal status, the permanent residency. In addition, there is a very direct policy of home demolition against the Palestinians in Jerusalem. Usually when the Israeli officials are asked about demolishing Palestinian homes, they say, oh no, no, let's be clear. We do not demolish Palestinian homes. We demolish illegally constructed homes. Again, factually, it could be true. Let's add a little bit more details to that statement. So in the last 6 years, excuse me, the Israeli authorities have rejected 94% of the Palestinian applications for building permits, which in other words means Palestinians do build illegally in Jerusalem because the Israeli authorities do not allow them to build legally. So Palestinians who own lands and want to build homes, and sometimes not a home, sometimes it's just an additional bedroom and kitchen and bathroom for the newly wedded son that cannot find the land to build a new home on, so they add a mini unit for the young couple, but then any addition, any construction with a roof needs and requires a permit. And then when you build without the permit, because they refuse to give you the permit, that is reason good enough for them to come demolish your house or the additional room. Usually, by the way, when you go apply for a permit, they say, we cannot give you a permit because the master plan for your neighborhood hasn't been developed to include new construction. And then the question comes up of, who's in charge of developing those master plans? The only authority controlling the city, the Israeli authority, which intentionally refuses to develop those master plans and then uses it as an excuse for preventing us the building permits. So, in short, Palestinians do build illegally in Jerusalem because that's what Israel forces them to do, and then Israel uses that as an excuse to demolish their homes. I also have to say that Palestinians in Jerusalem live in severe poverty. And that also is a planned strategy. That's not a coincidence. That doesn't happen in a vacuum. The killing and suffocating of Palestinian economy is one of those displacement policies that are used against the Palestinian presence in Jerusalem. And so in Jerusalem today, among the Palestinian residents, there is an 80% poverty rate. Imagine a town with 80% of the population of the residents living below the official poverty line. 83% of the minors, by the way. Excuse me. In addition to uprooting people by taking the land and the homes, the Israeli authorities also make every single aspect of our daily lives a big challenge. It's a challenge to go to school because there is a severe lack in schools for Palestinian kids in Jerusalem. Today, the number of missing classrooms for Palestinian kids is 2,000 classrooms. That's thousands and thousands of Palestinian kids that do not have schools to go to at the beginning of every school year. In addition, existing schools face a severe lack in budgets. Usually Israel says, the Israeli authorities say, you use our curriculum, we give you budgets. If you do not use our curriculum, we do not give you budgets. And of course, forcing the Israeli curriculum is forcing the Israeli Zionist narrative on the Palestinian kids, Palestinian residents living under occupation, under an occupation authority, have the right by international law to learn their own curriculum, to learn their own narrative. Another basic human rights that is a human right that Israel violates against the Palestinians in Palestine in general. In addition, of course, there is a lack in infrastructure. Our roads are not paved properly. In our neighborhoods, there isn't proper garbage collection. There isn't proper lighting of the streets. There is a lack of connecting homes to water networks and electricity networks. And in addition to all of this, there is a severe lack in hospitals as well. In Jerusalem, there are only 5 hospitals serving the Palestinian communities, so 5 hospitals serving more than 300,000 residents. In these 5 hospitals, there are only 2 emergency rooms. In addition, there is a wall that is isolating Jerusalem from the rest of the West Bank. In 2003, Israel started building the annexation and expansion wall that some people call also the apartheid wall, which Israel calls a security fence. And this wall, regardless now, I mean, I would love to go into the discussion about security or not, but maybe for later, security or not, the wall sits deep inside Palestinian territory. I mean, you would imagine, I mean, I'm not a big believer in the saying that good fences make good neighbors. But let's say that Israel does. Where would you expect Israel to build the wall? On the border with the neighbors, not deep inside the neighbor's backyard. And this is exactly what Israel does with this wall. The wall annexes a huge part of the Palestinian territory to Israel, especially in Jerusalem. And this wall, in addition to annexing the land for the expansion of settlements, for the creation of settler roads that connect Northwest Bank settlements through Jerusalem to Southwest Bank settlements. In addition, and most importantly, when it comes to the Palestinian perspective, this wall cuts off the ties and the relationships between Jerusalem and the neighboring Palestinian cities. Bethlehem in the south, Jericho in the east, and Ramallah in the north. This way, political ties, cultural ties, social ties, but most importantly, economic ties are cut off. the flow of goods and customers that is thousands of years old, that has been happening between Jerusalem and its neighboring cities, has been cut off with the construction of the wall, leading to a drastic rise in unemployment and in poverty. And today, the Palestinian economy in Jerusalem is suffocated due to this isolation, and so leading to the rise yearly, a drastic rise in the poverty rates. Now, this is the reality that Palestinians face when they live in their daily lives under the Israeli occupation. And our own political leadership is absent in Jerusalem. As a result of the Oslo Agreement, which some people mistakenly think is a peace agreement, another thing that I would love to discuss later if we have the time. Oslo deserves its own six-hour conversation. But I can tell you that Oslo is another catastrophe that fell upon the Palestinian people, and mostly because it's a midterm agreement that during the negotiations for Oslo, Israel said, there are five topics we will not discuss for now. We leave them for the final agreement. These five topics were the return of the refugees, the final status of Jerusalem, borders, settlements, and water. You tell me what's left. And so, obviously, any agreement built on these conditions is going to help the status quo. And who benefits from the status quo? The Israeli occupation and the Israeli authorities. And so Oslo, some people mistakenly thought that it's going to bring peace. Oslo did not bring peace. Oslo actually made our catastrophe bigger. And Oslo made our own Palestinian economy trapped within the Israeli economy. Today there is only one economy and only one market all over historic Palestine, and that is the Israeli market. That is the Israeli economy. The Palestinian economy is just a hostage for that Israeli economy. Now, in addition, another result of Oslo was the fact that the Palestinian Authority has no jurisdiction in Jerusalem. Again, not surprising. I mean, let's face it, Israel wants the city. Israel wants the whole city. Israel does not want to divide the city, and Israel wants to kick the Palestinians out. And so, the Palestinian Authority being absent, with the Israeli threat on the Palestinian communities, leaves these Palestinian residents living in a vacuum. Who's advocating in our name? Who is implementing development in our communities? Certainly not our Palestinian Authority. So these tasks are left in the hands of United Nations agencies, international NGOs, donors, the international aid system. And usually this aid that comes into Palestine comes in a top-down manner. So it comes with an agenda attached to it, a political agenda. I give the money, I tell you exactly how to spend it. I tell you where to put each cent. So this way, the donor or the helper, they come with their own agenda, with their own perception of what Palestinian liberation should look like, what development in Palestinian communities should look like, and they come and impose their own agenda on the Palestinian communities. Which means that we have no voice. We, the Palestinians in Jerusalem, have no loud voice. No one hears us, no one asks us about our vision for the city, and no one asks us what change we wish to see in our city. And within this reality, the organization I work for, Grassroots Jerusalem, was born in 2011, and we decided that we are not going to be another civil society organization that does the same thing or similar things that already exist and similar work that already exists, that we would like to start building networks between the different Palestinian organizations and the different Palestinian communities in Jerusalem so that they together raise a louder voice saying what their vision for the city is. So we started our work by mapping the Palestinian communities in Jerusalem. Our field coordinators went into the communities, had a lot of tea and coffee, sat with people in these neighborhoods and villages and the two refugee camps in the city, and first of all, heard the story. So first thing we do is provide that space for the communities to tell their story with their own words. So they tell you the history of the place, and they tell you the reality they're facing today. Reality, of course, includes mainly challenges faced under the Israeli occupation. And then the next question we asked was, so who's doing what regarding this reality in your community? Who are the community organizations active here? Who are the community leaders and organizers active here? Grassroots movements that are not necessarily registered as official organizations. And so we started also mapping civil society in Jerusalem. So far we have mapped 40 communities and 80 community organizations. And the profile for a community organization or grassroots group, first of all, includes their vision for Jerusalem. That's why I said it's the toughest question, because that's the question they couldn't answer when we started that conversation. I mean, you go and sit with a 50-year-old man who is active in his community for 20 years now, and you tell him, so what's your vision for Jerusalem in 10 years? And he goes like, Habibti, I have no idea how my community is going to look like in 10 years. I don't know if we're going to even have the land that's over there, or we're going to have the people that live in this community. So I have a demolition order over my house. My son is in jail. My daughter lives behind the wall. I haven't seen her in ages. So these people, the Palestinian people living, facing these immediate challenges, cannot answer the question for the far future. So we realized that we needed to do two things in parallel. The first thing is help the communities face and react to their immediate concerns by, first of all, mapping and finding the resources available for them to mobilize around these issues of immediate concern. If there is a land confiscated for a national park, or if there are 22 homes under the risk of being demolished for the creation of a biblical park, that is an actual story in the neighborhood of Silwan in Jerusalem, south of the Old City, then first of all, the community needs to battle this, to fight this battle, to resist the threat, the immediate threat. Only then can they sit together with other Palestinians and start forming that long-term strategy for the city. So at the same time, we also create the space for Palestinian communities and Palestinian organizations to meet and discuss long-term strategies, so that when someone asks us, but also when we ask ourselves, what do I envision my city to look like in 10 years? We can answer that question, and we can actually work sustainably towards that goal. And that's also part of our advocacy towards the aid system, the international aid, whether it is the United Nations and other agencies or the donors. Because the way they treat Palestine today is as if it is suffering from a humanitarian crisis, as if Palestine was hit by a hurricane or a tsunami. They give emergency relief, providing alternative shelter to families that lost their homes due to home demolition. They provide some economic generating income activities for some communities or community members. But if this type of help works only when there is actually a natural crisis, not when there is a human crisis. And what's happening in Palestine is not a tsunami. What's happening in Palestine is a political tsunami. And so there is need also for these long-term strategies, and there is need to help end the reason for our need for this emergency response. If you keep providing band-aids and not curing the wound, then we Palestinians will always need these UN agencies to be present and to help us, to provide protection to kids in the West Bank that are stoned by settlers on the way to school. I mean, if the settlements do not disappear, then there will always be need for volunteers to walk the kids to school so that they don't get hit by stones. And we think that is also true for the donor money that comes usually, as I said, with the political agenda attached to it. They tell you what to do with it. They think that they know better than us what's good for our city. So We advocate also that they take the Palestinian lead and that they follow the Palestinian prioritizing of the needs of the communities. Only in that way can the Palestinians actually overcome the challenges in a sustainable way, by a cumulative work, sustainable work that is building towards a goal, a long-term goal. And one might think, after such a presentation, that the situation is only black in Jerusalem. It's devastating, it's really bad to know what's going on there, and but that's not the only thing that's happening in Jerusalem. Also in Jerusalem, there are communities that are resisting in creative ways, in beautiful ways, and most importantly, in sustainable ways. So to finish my presentation with the good news, and because I think as a Palestinian that it is crucial that you hear the good news. It's crucial that you know that the Palestinians are not giving up, that the Palestinians are not just sitting and waiting for salvation. I will finish with an example from the village called Beit Dukku. Beit Dukku is a village out of 9 villages that are located northwest of Jerusalem. These villages are farming communities. And with the construction of the wall, these communities have been isolated from Jerusalem, on the one hand, by the wall, but also from their own agricultural lands. That's a pattern that exists all over the West Bank. Farmers on one side of the wall, their lands on the other side of the wall. Keep in mind that the Israeli law says that if you own land, farming land, and you don't work it for 3 years, the Israeli government has the right to confiscate it. So we separate you from your land, we do not allow you to work them, and then we say, oh, check, criteria, check, it's there, you didn't work your land, we take it. So that in the village of Beit Dukku, similar to many other villages around the West Bank, the farmers were isolated from their lands. They could only access the lands through what Israel calls an agricultural gate. Sounds great, no? The agricultural gate is a door this size in the wall that opens for only 1 hour a day. Half an hour in the morning at 6:30 and half an hour in the afternoon at 4. And usually it also doesn't open on time. So you as a farmer, you get to the gate and you wait for the soldier to come open the door for you. And you wait from 6:30 to 8:30 to enter your land. And then coming back with your cucumbers and tomatoes and peppers, you wait and wait and wait in the sun for the soldier to come back and open the door for you. And in the meantime, your vegetables get soft in the sun. And you can't sell them in the market as fresh vegetables. And so what can you do with rotten tomatoes? So the farmers starting giving up on farming all in all, leaving the lands and going to work as employees in the or workers in the nearby city of Ramallah. The Beit Dukku Development Society, our partners in the village, came up with a brilliant model. They started providing seeds and plants to the farmers and then buying the harvest from the farmers. So whatever produce you have, we'll buy it. This way, they solved the problem for the farmers, right? So the farmers still can make livelihood, generate income from their vegetables. But then the development society is stuck with the rotten tomatoes. So what do? They open a facility, a little factory, processing factory, very small, modest, under their offices. And there, instead of selling fresh tomatoes, they make tomato paste and make sun-dried tomatoes. Instead of selling fresh cucumbers and peppers, they pickle them. And trust me when I say it's the best food you can eat. In addition, they opened a sheep and cow farm. They have a sheep farm and a cow farm, and they make dairy. Today, they make enough yogurt that answers the needs of the 9 villages around them. So also a beautiful example of self-sufficiency. And now that they have the animals and the plants, they have the ingredients for a compost. So they make organic compost. They started with one machine, now they have another machine, they make organic compost that is being sold all over the West Bank. And the model is so successful. First of all, many families started returning and they wanted to become part of this project. They come to the development society and say, I want to go back and work my land. In addition, other communities around the West Bank, facing the same reality as Beit Dukko, come to Beit Dukko to learn about the model. They come from as far as Jenin in the north of the West Bank, or Al-Khadr near Beit Lahem, or Qalqilya, or Salfit. All of these areas in the West Bank come to Beit Dukko to learn this model so that they can do it, they can implement it also in their own communities, and in this way, sustainably resist the occupation. So it's just one example of hundreds that exist in Palestine, exist in Jerusalem. You usually don't hear about them because they are under the radar. They are local, they are very localized, and they serve one community. And I see it as my own responsibility, first of all, to highlight them, for you to see them, to put them under the spotlight, but also my responsibility is to help them find those networks that help them survive. Thank you very much.
That was Farouz Sharkawi of Grassroots Jerusalem. And now we present Madonna Thunderhawk from the Lakota Nation. Madonna Thunderhawk is known as the grandmother to a generation of Native American activists. She stood with her people at Pine Ridge, Wounded Knee, the takeover at Alcatraz, and Standing Rock, to name just a few. She is co-founder of Women of Red Nations and member of the American Indian Movement. Here is Madonna Thunderhawk.
All the work I've done over the years since I was young, back in the 60s, it's basically one thing, and that's our land base. Right here in the United States, west of the Mississippi, is where the larger land base is that we left. But my people and my ancestors come from the Northern Plains, central area of the United States, Northern Plains. No trees, just a few, I guess, that are imported. We have some trees around that area of the waterways, but not open plains, mostly. But our history with the United States has always been love-hate. Because this country was founded on violence and genocide, they glorified my ancestors because we stood and fought. We didn't go away, we didn't disappear, we didn't assimilate. Stood our ground. When they refer to Indian Wars, they usually refer to my ancestors. Back in the 1800s, when the settlers started coming in our area, they'd already been here for several hundred years, but when they got further west, it was the army, the cavalry, and the Christians. And they came, whiskey in one hand and Bible in the other. And the army had the guns. So as a result of that, we're heavily colonized, even today, our thinking. We're predominantly handout mentality from the same situation as Beirut Hussein. They deal with NGOs, we deal with do-good organizations, religious, whatever, that are looking for basically numbers, I guess, still have that missionary mentality. And the local politics of the area is still frontier mentality. So that's the groundwork. That's what's happened. That's decade after decade, that's what's going on, that mentality. So to maintain what we have left, there's just pockets of resistance in what we call Indian country, mainly reservation areas in the west. it's large extended families that have a lot of Hunkar relatives. Hunkar doesn't mean adoption. We don't do that. That's a bad thing. We make a relative. Anyway, we, you know, over the years, it's the continuing battle to save what we have left by strong extended families that influence the modern day tribal governments, which are patterned after the United States government. So basically what we're doing is holding things down in spite of the colonization that's still going on, the colonized thinking. Our beautiful example, our beautiful, wonderful values that we had, our ancestors had, anymore are just beautiful posters on the wall because we're colonized people. We think in terms of always looking up in the course of the poor sometimes are the greediest. So those are the things we're dealing with constantly. But when it comes to land, that's who we are. That's our identity. So these strong pockets of resistance, we keep that original fire alive that our ancestors had. In the past, it's always been a battle with government agencies. When it comes to land and resources, it's always been the Army Corps of Engineers. For example, in the 50s, Congress passed the Howard Wheeler Act, where they created, for flood control, they created dams on the Missouri River, all adjacent to Indian reservations, to control flooding. And there's now the largest freshwater reservoir in the continental United States is right there, the shoreline of my reservation. It's called the Owyhee Dam. And that was a result of the Howard Wheeler Act. And they built the dams in 1960, they opened the gates and started damming up the Missouri River. So we've been in this water fight for generations. So my reservation alone, we sacrificed close to 1 million acres to the national interest. So all this land taking, all this taking didn't stop in the 1800s. We're still sacrificing for this country today. And because we don't have the political power and we don't have the economic power, we have to depend on allies in this country. We depend now on religious organizations who aren't into missionary work, but they're interested in helping us on a survival level. And that takes on a lot of areas. But right now, our struggle and our fight is in the courts. We can't depend on the politics because we don't have that. Like I told you, we don't have that political power to do anything there. But because our ancestors signed treaties back in the 1800s, and each treaty that was signed was a taking, and our ancestors knew that. Each treaty from 1851 on up to 1868 were treaties of taking, where our ancestors ceded millions of acres of land, but it was for our survival. And the treaty era happened because the federal government was weak after the Civil War, and they came in and they said, wait a minute, we can't spend $1 million a year for forts and skirmishes and fighting these Indians out in the Dakota Territory. The United States government was weak. So they came, established a treaty commission to come and sue for peace. And that was because our ancestors stood their ground. But we were weak also because of disease. There was European diseases that our ancestors had no resistance to. Things like measles and tuberculosis was taking its toll. So our ancestors would sit down with them and do these treaties for survival. But the key here is a lot of other of our indigenous people, indigenous nations in this continent did the same thing, but there were usually treaties with local groups or with states at the time that the states were developed. But our treaties were with the United States government, and they were ratified by Congress, which makes them the law of the land. Statutory law. So that's why we can make a stand like we did at Standing Rock under our treaty. So now we have reservation boundaries, and that's where we live in this modern day. And that has a lot to do with jurisdiction, you know, under federal jurisdiction, you know, opposed to state jurisdiction, and the counties don't, you know, it has all this kind of local stuff. But legally, we still have our treaty boundaries, which are extended, which includes, you know, southern half of North Dakota, you know, clear practically to the foothills of the Rockies to the west. I mean, that's another story. But because those treaty boundaries were ratified by Congress and illegally taken since 1868, the treaty still stands because it was ratified by Congress. So that's why we can make those kinds of stand. And we can say, no, you're not going to, you know, we don't want this pipeline, because originally it was supposed to go north of Bismarck, Mandan, the state capital of North Dakota. But they realized, oh, wait a minute, no. When that pipe goes under the Missouri River, and when it busts, they don't leak, they bust. Inferior materials that these pipes are made out of. Most of them come from China. Go on the internet, see if I'm telling facts here. We know that. The research was done. So they know that pipe is going to bust eventually, so that would poison all the water for Mandan and Bismarck. So let's put the pipeline below, just between Bismarck and the reservation. Let's put it there, let it cross there, because the reservation is downstream. Not to mention the large dam reservoir, and then the state capital of South Dakota is in the middle of the state, Pierce, South Dakota, which is right on the Missouri. Not to mention their water is going to be poisoned, and then all the way down to Nebraska, you know, all the way to the Mississippi. Because it's not just oil, it's all the chemicals that are used to push this crude or whatever it is through these pipes. It's not refined oil that's going through there. Chemicals. Heavy-duty chemicals. But there's no restrictions now. These fossil fuel corporations can do anything they want, and they can contaminate anything they want, because there's no regulations to say you have to clean it up. They did away with those. All those regulations my generation, all of us, fought for back in the 60s and 70s, when we had the no-nukes movement going on. Not to mention stop the Vietnam War. So yeah, we could pat ourselves a little bit on the shoulder, but then what did we do after that? We went to sleep. And the result, what do we have? Corporate control of our... It's not a democracy anymore. And I can say that because I'm on the outside looking in. The rest of the country's asleep. We're still a democracy. Oh, whoop-de-doo. They don't even know it. Corporate control of both houses of Congress, not to mention the White House. But anyway, another story. So it's a continuation. There's nothing new. Oh, so what's going to happen? Oh, Standing Rock is over now, so what are you going to do? What? I've had people ask me that. You know? That's just a continuation of our struggle to maintain what we have left. And because English and education was forced on our people. My grandmother was forced to go to... That's where it started. And then my mother, it was during the 30s, the Great Depression of this country. So her and all her siblings were put in the boarding school system by choice, by My grandparents, because of the depression, because they were fed 3 meals a day. And because my mother grew up in that system, she stayed there when she got in high school. She stayed there in the summertime too and worked so she could send money home to her mom, her family, in the 30s. Yeah, so like I said, it's a continuing issue. The issues are not new for us. We're indigenous to this land. And I say this, if I can remember, whenever I give a talk, I say this. We do not have a gene pool anywhere else. You people aren't in the, your descendants aren't in danger of being gone. You got a gene pool in Europe or everywhere else on the planet, wherever your colonist ancestors went. We don't. This is it for us, right here on this continent. That we belong here. That's why we stand and we're still here. I'm still here because my ancestors made a stand and they changed tactics for the survival of the people. And we also learn because the word in our language, Dakota, that's a dialect of half of our people. The other half on the western part of the Missouri River are L, or Lakotas. It's a dialect. And those words mean allies. Because we were, what the government ended up calling us was the Great Sioux Nation. And the Sioux was some kind of fractured French and Algonquin word, I heard, that, you know, they brought with them from, the colonizers brought. So, the Great Sioux Nation is what the United States labeled us. So that's what our treaties say. Okay? So the wording in them in the modern and in the colonizers' government is really important. You stick to those words. So that's why in English words they say, what would you rather be called? Indian, native, indigenous, whatever. I don't care. Call me an Indian, I don't care. Because every one of us, individual indigenous nations in this country, have our own name for ourselves and our own language still. So when you meet up with somebody that says they're Indian or native, you say, okay, where are you from? And they don't say, well, I'm from South Dakota or I'm from the East Coast or no. If they're native, they know what you're saying. Where's your territory? Where's your res? Where's your community? And out here, someone would probably say, Satan, well, Wampanoag. But right away, I know that they know what they're talking about. So when they ask me, I said, Lakota. Ah, South Dakota, yeah. Uh-huh. Or Dakota, you know. So I think that's what's in the blood of all indigenous that are still on their land. That's why we have allies. The first time I heard about Palestine was in 1973 after Wounded Knee. Two speakers came to speak to us. The American Indian Movement had this big gathering of people. And one of them was a Palestine speaker and the other one was from Northern Ireland. Those that want in Ireland, that want their independence, they've been fighting for 800 years. Because I went there. And it was just part of how we were. Is that you talk about what you see and hear with your own eyes and your own ears. And if you read something, it's I read. Or if you saw something on TV, I saw that. But that's not, you know, you got to make that. So if I'm going to talk about something, I have to say, well, I was there and I saw it. So I'm going to Palestine. Because the tie is there, we're indigenous to our land. So no matter what governments roll in, no matter what policies they slap on you. So yeah, I'm in it for the long haul. There's all kinds of issues that are going on. We're still fighting the state of South Dakota. over our trafficking in our children. Real basic, you get children into the system, the welfare, the, we call it welfare, the Department of Social Services, foster care system. Automatically, the state gets X amount of dollars for white kids or anybody that is non-native. Indian children, native children, automatically are labeled special needs, and they get twice as much money, the system does, for native child. So it's just like a revolving door in South Dakota. So these young, usually a young single parent with dysfunction or problems, boom, their kids are gone. And maybe the grandmother, say I'm the grandmother, I've raised these kids since they were born, I've been in the same house, the social services will come, and usually with the police, and they'll take those kids out of bed, out of the grandmother's home. Because legally, we don't have to deal with you. You're non-existent. We just deal with the dysfunctional mother. And then they get them in the system, and it's all for money. The state of South Dakota could care less about native children up until federal policies changed and the pharmaceutical companies got control of the Republican governor's organization for the western states, had an agreement going with the pharmaceutical companies, because that's where the large Indian organization was. So when these Indian kids get in, if they're little, they can deal with them, but if they're any older, they run. They take off to go home. So that's where the drugs come in. Keep everybody docile. So we're fighting that issue. And those kids are kept like that in the system until they age out, usually until they age out. And then they're literally brought in a van and dumped, well, you're from Pine Ridge, dump you there. Sometimes grandmothers won't even, they'll say, I called and they said that he aged out and I don't know where he is. Where'd he go? Well, we don't know. We left him in Rapid City because that's where we picked him up 8 years ago, you know? So those kinds of things are constantly going on. And these kids are on these behavioral drugs all these years and all of a sudden they aged out to cut off. So they're dumped back somewhere and now we have a drug problem. More. The whole country does. Okay? But it's real, because we're a small population, you know, and we're a confined population, it's everything, all the dysfunction is just magnified. So it just goes from, you know, it's like a ripple. So that battle's going on. At the same time, everything's a crisis. Everything's a crisis. So then last year, the water, Standing Rock happened. So I ended up going with my family, extended family, up to Standing Rock. We stayed for 6 months. Because if you don't have water, what? You don't have life. Water is life. And for us, it's right in our face. Out here, I don't know what your story is, you know? But evidently, it's not a crisis. But back home, it is for us. It is. So you drop this crisis and you run over here and do this crisis. Because we're colonized people, the doers, like I said, the strong families, extended families, we are the ones that lead the fight. So yeah, that's my story.
You have been listening to Madonna Thunderhawk from the Lakota Nation. And that is all the time we have this morning. Thanks for listening to This Week in Palestine. We will be back next Sunday morning, so please join us then. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.